Renegade Broadcasting, hard-hitting talk radio. Big hi to you, brothers and sisters, and another 1488. Here we are on the last week of September. Well, I've been busy writing, and how much writing have I been doing? Well, a lot. And that is the subject of tonight's show, is my current projects, which include an article on Renegade Tribune, which will be appearing tomorrow morning. It is chiefly about none other than the ancient Aryan theory versus the now traditional and popular ancient alien theory, and in fact debunks the ancient alien theory in favor of the ancient Aryan theory. So I won't get into all of it, but one of the things that is evident to me in my research is that this ancient alien theory is nothing new. It is primarily based on the works of Euphorus, who basically championed and then outlined much of the ideas of Herodotus with regards to the idea that these ancient myths of gods and goddesses and giants in Greek mythology actually were based on real characters in real events that were later misinterpreted and became divine, which when you realize that it's the same thing that Georgios Sokolos is always saying with his famous line, it's not the aliens, it's just the aliens, you know, and he says these are just misinterpreted flesh and blood extraterrestrials, and our ancestors merely thought they were gods because they looked magical. You know, that actually is demeaning to our own race, because much of that mythology and much of the ancient civilizations featured on that television program are in fact rooted in white civilization. I mean, even when you consider the ancient South American and North American tribes, their legends are quite clear, you know, that we descend from, you know, they descend from ancient Caucasian-like beings. At least their culture does, that they were visited by ancient Caucasian-like beings, and it's those beings which gave them civilization. Now, the interesting question is this just another example of euphorism? Well, it could be. But the very fact that people with no contact are being so very specific, talking about yellow hair and eyes as blue as the sky, that does ring a little bit more than just psychological archetypes the kind discussed by Carl Jung and others like Eric Fromm. So there is something more to it in that sense. But I kind of think that it's like what Joseph Campbell said, if you've ever read any of his works. He discussed how the ancient mythmakers and the people themselves knew these were myths. They knew they were yarns. In fact, there was even, and this is actually documented, you know, the bards would come to the cities, like the Greek city-states, and sit around and make up tales. They were like, these myths were like their plays or their, in our own civilization, their own YouTube downloads. So they were well aware of what they were. But it wasn't the story themselves or the contents of those stories which made these myths significant. It was, in fact, that they represented a higher symbolism, a higher plane of thought. And when they realized what these stories actually represented in that sense, that's what made them sacred. And it takes more intelligence, more sophistication, more civilization to create a complex theology based on myths than it does merely recording down a bunch of spaceships coming from the planet Nibiru, which a planet we know never existed. So, and as far as Euphorism is concerned, you know, I have to disagree with D.M. Murdoch in one respect. She's wrong in one thing only. It isn't pseudoscience. There is some basis to that idea that some of these legends have real significance or based partly on historical reality. There's a lot of scholarship that tries to figure that out about King Arthur. And of course, we know that the Iliad actually was not completely untrue. They actually found Troy. So they know now that the Trojan War must have some basis in reality. Because look at modern Hollywood. I'm not going to use Jews as that much of an example, but, you know, in Hollywood, we adapt historical or semi-historical movies and go to see them and produce them and make them part of our pop culture. So the ancient myth makers were doing the same thing. However, this was, I'm not going to get into all of the different things. I definitely want to recommend tomorrow you going on to Renegade Tribune and checking this out. I also would encourage you to go to ancientaryans.com and ariandawn.com, as they are basically my sites, and they have all my previous radio shows and articles posted there. However, there is something else I'd like to announce. In 3 weeks' time, just in time for Christmas, we are releasing via MoneyTreePublishing.com White Christmas. This book, White Christmas, is about our holiday. Not Hanukkah, not Kwanzaa, not Diwali. Nothing but a pure white Christmas of our tradition, our origin, our way of life. And that has basically, in the past good 10 years, has suffered a major blow. I had mentioned in the book that it all started one Christmas when the Clintons were in the White House, and is started with their legacy of basically trying so hard to support organizations and institutions which belittled our Christmas traditions. And I rather go in a rather novel perspective that it's not as much as it is an anti-Christian assault by the Jews on our traditions and holidays. It's even more so because our holidays are white holidays. Even with Christianity, it basically in ancient times was a white religion. To be a member of the Catholic Church way back when, you had to be white. And it remained that until Christopher Columbus rediscovered the New World. We know that the Vikings were the first, and there were many other possible contacts before that. But when they discovered the Amerindians in the New World, that was a major scandal in the sense that while the missionaries wanted to baptize them and make them Christians, and since most people, when they first heard about these beings, did not believe they descended from the Adamic race, that they basically were not human beings in the sense of fall from grace and so forth, all the Christian nonsense. And so that goes back to how what I'm saying is that there was no pure concept of anything beyond Christianity being a white religion at that time. And that was quickly overtaken later on. But our holiday, Christmas, you know, it could be called Yule. Those who celebrate the old traditions of our people, the pre-Christian traditions, we celebrate basically the same holiday. Devoid of Christianity, it's the same holiday. Christmas trees, Christmas gifts, greenery. You know, there's really no difference. And especially in today's times, with relatively an anti-Christian sentiment growing, it basically is becoming more and more the same. They're coalescing into one single holiday. But we have to remember that, I point this in the book, is that Christ is truly not the center of the holiday, because the Christian tradition of the Savior being born of a virgin on December 25th and growing up in the same way it's described in the Bible with the 12 disciples and finally the crucifixion to death in 3 days in resurrection, is based on the Aryan sun gods. Because in the book I show 12 examples of different sun gods in Europe, in the Near East, in Aryan lands, which describe the same thing as you read in the Bible. So you're wondering, when you're reading this, you know, why? I mean, you know, you're being raised to think, once you enter the movement, that Christianity is such a Jewish festival. You know, it's so Jewish and so based on the Jewish Bible, you know, and then you read all of a sudden, you actually do the research, you learn that the Jews actually stole a lot of these myths and traditions. They didn't make them up themselves to deceive the world. They stole them to deceive the world. They stole our Aryan myths. Like, for instance, Moses, when he's put in a reed basket and put down the stream, is actually an Aryan myth based on Sargon the First, who was the first true emperor in the Western civilization in Babylon. And since the Jews were in captivity in Babylon, they knew about that. So I talk a little bit about that, some of the different myths, and then get into the specific nativity. I cite D.M. Murdoch frequently in this section of the book. But there's a lot more to look at. In addition to talking about the Aryan sun god myths and the origin of the nativity from a mythological standpoint, I also talk about the war on Christmas. I get into it from both the angle of conservatives who talk about the war on Christianity and talk a little bit about the Jewish obsession with that aspect of our culture and actually explain that it really has nothing to do with the fact that, well, the fact that it's a Jewish book. I also talk about how our own traditions, that even the Christian traditions, you know, like I was saying, the area with Christ himself, but also the morality that we usually define as indicative of Christmas as being, in fact, of Aryan origin. And I go into much more detail as we go on. And I talk about Santa Claus. I talk about the old dark traditions of Christmas. Because one of the things that people don't realize is that Christmas actually, at one time in our past, looks more like Halloween than it does what we would recognize as the rosy and cheery, you know, white Christmas that we all dream about. It was actually a white Christmas with a dark flavor. I mean, there were jack-o'-lanterns, there were the Pumpkin, who in the Germanic lands are like a hideous witch. There was the Krampus, who was like a devil-like assistant. And you know, the interesting thing is, these creatures, especially the male creatures, who have their origins back with the wild man and the fertility gods, and the gods of the hunt, it's by tradition to make them look negroid-like. And that's very strange for these beings to look that way. And they're actually having a hard time from Arabs, who are now migrants, and also immigrants who are of Negro origin. They're complaining that by taking a burnt cork and putting all kinds of darkness all over their faces, that they're mocking the blacks, just like they'd said in this country, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago. And isn't it ironic now on Halloween, it's more custom, rather than putting blackness over your face, which they always did. My parents always mentioned that they would put blackness over their faces in the 1940s when they would go out for Halloween. Now it's put white on your face. So they're actually shifting symbolism to make darkness and evil in Halloween to look, you know, that dark aspect of our culture to reflect whiteness as dark and evil and blackness as good. You kind of get the symbolism? It's a very, very subtle way of promoting an image of the white as evil and the black as, you know, just and right and true. And you will see this, you know, it's happening more and more. And I've said this before, it's more than just blackwashing our pop culture and our history. It's got an almost sexual aspect to it. It's to make the black male be the epitome of masculinity, success, style, everything but beauty. Because in my opinion, black people are not a beauteous race. But they're able to bring up that sexual edge so that it's reincorporated into our media over and over. So when young white women, when children growing up as teens, older and older, they're getting programmed to view the black as the most logical mate for them in the future. And this is, again, is what I talk about, the whole purpose of blackwashing culture. It's not just the sexual edge to it, but when our people can't identify with white cultural heroes or mythology or folklore, they're losing that. And also they try to bury folklore in the old sense of the word because it removes our connection with nature. I mean, that's something the Third Reich was very, very adamant about, is promoting the German folklore for the German folk. If you eliminate that animalistic, innate, folkloric sense of the word culture from a people, they're no longer able to identify with not only their own culture, but to nature. And see, that's what we're really facing in the future. As our world becomes more and more technological, we have to face a decision. Are we going to technologicize ourselves out of existence? Or are we going to embrace technology? And the interesting thing about National Socialism and National Socialist Germany was they were able to balance both. They had both the technology and the link to nature. And that is another thing I am going to be talking about in this book, is Christmas in NS Germany. One of the things you see a lot of when you're reading academic papers, mostly written by Jews, is that they make a big deal about this aspect of Third Reich using Christmas to create a stronger sense of national unity and to create a greater awareness of National Socialism, as well as continuing on with the traditional Child of Light, Christ Child, and of course, reviving the old German myths. And they often say that, well, they're trying to create a pagan holiday and throw away thousands of years of tradition. No, they simply acknowledge that Christmas has roots in the pre-Christian past, and for a race to be completely know itself, they have to have a link to that past. So they were reviving old German traditions that had been in existence for thousands of years. And secondly, why not use it to create national unity and promote National Socialism? I mean, in the Civil War, I mean, there was really no big Christmas festival in America, at least universally, the Civil War. They used it to promote either side, the Confederates and the Union, both promoted Christmas as a nationalistic festival. And also World War II. They did the same thing there, and in World War I before that. So why couldn't the Third Reich do that? And then American army doing the same thing for their troops. It doesn't ring true to me, but that's the Jews, and that's how they run the game. I just heard a recording, a broadcast that was on here from a previous Solar Storm episode with Kyle Hunt. And he was talking about the disparity and contradiction that's going on with the white minority in South Africa. How the blacks are pushing affirmative action against the white minority, and how the whites are living in shacks and are experiencing the greatest extent of harassment, discrimination, and murder, and rape, but that our nation and our world does nothing about it, simply because they're white. If they were black, that would be a different thing. So there is a strong double standard which exists simply because the ones in power, the ones in world power, are inherently anti-white. And people can't see this. I was talking with the head of Ancient Mysteries International, Bruce Cunningham. And he was one of my former colleagues when I was, like Kyle Hunt said, back in the days when I was writing Graham Hancockian-style material. Ancient Aliens and Lost Civilizations, Atlantis and Giants. he literally thinks I should go back to writing that. And I just want to say, for the record, I can't imagine myself going back to where I was 7 years ago and writing that type of material. It was going nowhere. It served no useful purpose. It was no different than a million other writers that had existed throughout the 20th and even the 19th century. And what I'm doing now, I hope will add hope and wisdom and pride to those who read and understand my points and the purpose of my books. White Christmas will be available in 3 weeks, and my publisher wanted me to tell you that it will ship the very day you order it. We do not have a price yet. We will keep you informed as time goes on. One of the things I try to do in my writings is make it clear, and I do so in this book, that our holidays, our festivals, our white holidays and festivals, they're not to be given to other races to use as they see fit. There's kind of an idea that people have that our holidays should be open to everyone and everybody should be included. Now, the interesting thing is, if you look at any of their holidays, they're exclusive. Now, ask yourself, would I be welcome celebrating Hanukkah every year, considering I'm not Jewish? I mean, the Jews would not accept that, especially with my white nationalism. If I went into a synagogue tomorrow and said, "Hey, I'm Patrick Chouinard, the white nationalist, the pro-white author and journalist," I don't think they'd want me to celebrate that holiday. And frankly, I don't want blacks or Jews or anybody having any say or wherewithal on my holidays. They're mine. They're our race. We'll be back in just a few minutes to finish off that thought.
Of Judaism are issuing statements in support of refugees. These have included the Orthodox Union, the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, and so many of the Jewish organizations that you heard are co-sponsors of this event.
Now rising from below.
what I was saying was, I don't want anyone else's hands or say in my festivals as a proud white Aryan man. Then the Jews want white Aryans having say in their festivals, or trying to degrade or take away theirs. Which, by the way, I must also add that Hanukkah is not a real holiday. It was, you know, if you really look at its history, it was invented to go against Christmas, to be an alternative in the future when that time comes for them to make their long march into cultural Marxism. You see, this was planned for a very long time, and it was talked about in the Protocols of Zion, which I cite often, and they're talking about the day when they will eliminate holidays of great importance to the Gentile. So, it's the idea really struck me last year when I was sitting in the McDonald's having my coffee. An old man who I see often in McDonald's was reading a newspaper and said, the Mall of America has its first Black Santa. Boy, I like that. I like that. We're making progress. I just kind of shake my head and said, you know, there is even an old man who thinks that, who remembers White Christmas at its height, you know, is now saying that he thinks that's a good idea. I mean, I know it doesn't mean anything to a lot of people. You know, who cares? So we have a Black Santa. What? Big whoop. To me, it is a big whoop. Because it's the misrepresentation and defilement of a tradition that wasn't just invented with the Coca-Cola Company. It just wasn't invented in the 19th century. You know, maybe as a full package of who we would consider the mythical figure of Santa Claus, but it has its roots going way back, not just to St. Nicholas, a Christian figure. And by the way, you know, that figure itself is most likely fake as well. The Archbishop Methodius in the 4th century A.D. wrote that down about him. So there was no real records of Nicholas before Methodius made the statements that, you know, that Nicholas existed and did this and that. So we actually have to understand that that is itself a mythology. And our mythology, that of the white Aryan race, of the Christian tradition, that goes back way back. It goes as far back as 50,000 years into the past with the wild men and the ancient half-gods, which are ancestors. 40,000, 50,000, 60,000. Even our predecessors, the Cro-Magnon and Neanderthals. You know, and we were talking about that with Kyle on a previous show, how, you know, the Neanderthals were not completely unwhite. You know, they were white. They had light skin, blonde hair, red hair, green eyes, blue eyes. Some people have even suggested intermarriage with them could have caused that distinction. But, you know, I mean, Alan Thorne, who was an anthropologist, and he talked about this back in the 70s, that he believed that with flesh on the bones of Neanderthals, you know, especially when you consider that we now know they had our skin color, our color eyes, our color hair, they wouldn't look a whole lot different than our own people. In fact, I have some books that were recently published which show depictions of Neanderthals with white skin and red hair and blue eyes and how they would look with that, with the skin on them. And really, they don't look, you know, like an ape man or anything like that. They look very, very European. With the only difference is they look a little thicker around the forehead with the brow ridge distinct. Their nose is a little bit larger than even Europeans. And they have a little, their chin is slightly receding. But they do look European. I remember Kyle, I also want to mention this, I didn't quite answer him. There really was no difference between old Europeans, proto-Nordics, and Nordic Indo-Europeans or Aryans, because those were distinctions that were cultural, linguistic. They were all white peoples, very, very similar, in the same family, if not identical, and maybe just going by a different cultural distinction. But, you know, people try to make it sound like, you know, these were like immigrants, and the native white peoples were interbreeding with them and creating mixed children. They weren't a different race. They were merely another group of kindred white folk that our people were now embracing. And there's a lot of theories exactly how the Aryans entered Europe. You ask Maria Gimbutas, who wrote Goddesses and Gods of Old Europe, and many others, that anthropologist, she would tell you that they invaded the pre-Aryans, who were a matriarchal, goddess-worshipping society, and put on the patriarchal culture with the emphasis on war and horse-riding based philosophy of war and sacrifice and blood and soil. And I kind of more or less follow Colin Renfrew's idea. I don't believe in the Kurgan hypothesis. I more or less believe the Aryans existed in Anatolia, in Asia Minor, 9,000 to 10,000, even before that, because Anatolia and Asia Minor, basically the same thing, of course, they are rich in archaeological treasure. There are many sites, early cities, Göbekli Tepe, a 12,000-year-old temple complex, the oldest temple complex in the world. So we see great activity with civilization going back to an incredibly ancient time. Qatalhöyük, the world's first known city or proto-city, it's just amazing. And if ISIS ever gets in there, it's toast. It's history. They'll ruin that like they destroyed countless monuments of our white history. And, you know, I heard, I don't know, it was Kyle or someone else, they were talking about how the Jews are using this war, not in the way you would see Palpatine in Star Wars, you know, where he's financing both sides. So war would ensue and he would get his basic goal achieved, a new Sith Empire called the Empire. But I think that there's a reason why ISIS, beyond the political goal of achieving perhaps a greater Israel or just ridding, you know, this civilization of its best blood by sending our boys over there, about bringing over American black soldiers to wreak havoc on innocent people. They might not be white, they might be Arabic, but, you know, I think that this whole scheme is going in the direction where they want to depopulate the world enough that the Jews' plan of domination would be complete. Now, I think what they're doing is trying to rid ourselves of any ties to the true history of the white Aryan race. I think that that's their goal. I think that's what they want to achieve. There might be some ancient artifacts which will unlock some of our greatest mysteries as a race. And they don't want that to exist. They want it to look like white people were not in the Near East 4,000, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000, 12,000 years ago. That was a Semitic land or a dark-skinned land. Because isn't it ironic? They're destroying all the proof that we were a global white civilization at one time. At one time when the white race was 70% of the population of the world.
So they're doing it effectively, and they're destroying our history. And I think Anatolia would be the next step. But I think that that's where the Aryan race began. Or Aryan people, rather. I think that it was more of an evolution. And I think I don't believe that the Aryans invaded in the bloody sense of the word. I believe they were migrating in, and they were so similar to the old Europeans. I think rather than having, in our case, when we see miscegenation happening among races, you know, it's forced on us, basically. It's connived, it's shystered on us by Jews who control the media and control the government, and before you know it, they're encouraging and promoting and then facilitating miscegenation. But this wasn't like that, because this was not the mixture of two races or a group of races. This was the union of blood on blood, white on white. And this was a favorable union that was natural and appealing. You know, it's like when they first touched on each other, that flesh, that white flesh, had a semblance of familiarity to them, a feeling of brother and sisterhood, in the sense that they could understand each other in a profound way. And that's how it is when a member of another race mates. It's a beauty. And see, that's what our enemies fear, and they're trying to eliminate that connection. They're trying to falsely social engineer a new connection, a guttural, carnal, without reason attraction that really doesn't exist. It's a delusion of the most profound sort, that is twisting and essentially ruining our race. But no, and this is to respond to Kyle's question, that was an awesome moment, and they were both white. And when I come back later on, I want to talk more about this, but I do want to say this. Many people will ask the question, which is better, French, Irish, German, Russian? What European race, you know, in the old sense, is better? I say all of them. What matters is that I'm white. There is a great sensation of oneness when you just tell yourself, I'm white. And above all, get up every morning and say to yourself, what can I do to serve the white race? I do. I try to put that as an objective. And if you're trying to ask a question, what is National Socialism all about? You can go into economics. You can go into race theory. You can go into the Jews. But truthfully, it's got only one answer. The loyalty to the white Aryan race, and the white Aryan race alone. There is no other point which is more important, and which encompasses everything else, including the 14 words, than those basic ideas. Serve the white Aryan race. Loyalty to the white Aryan race. And that, in a nutshell, is what National Socialism is about. It's what I try to promote in my writings. So, we are going on to the second hour and 15 minutes, and I'll try to expedite our discussion further. when I wrote my first book, Forgotten Worlds, it was like having the ability to write, but having nothing to say. There was a feeling that I had to take other people's ideas, other people's research, call them together, cite them appropriately, and basically produce, which basically was a primer on Atlantis. It was just another book on Atlantis. I mean, even the guy, Robert Schuck, who wrote the foreword to my book, said, here's another book on Atlantis. And really, what more could I say about it? It didn't sell that great. I mean, those who were into the Atlantis deal thought it was awesome. Did not sell that well. It was a heck of a job to write. I felt no joy in it. And I did it because at the time, I don't know why I wrote that book, to be truthful with you. It was just something I was doing to feel around and get an idea of where my life would take off, which ideas were mine and mine alone, and where I would go from there. And it wasn't until I met a friend, and a skinhead friend, at a very traumatic time in my life, who told me that I was an intellectual, not a street fighter. And as such, it was my duty to use my intelligence and abilities to serve the white race. And that I'm an intellectual and that I would do excellent, either in propaganda for a prominent National Socialist organization, or as an independent writing the histories and heritage of the white race. So you might think, well, you were just picking up on someone else's idea. I don't think I look at it that way. This individual, I believe, was placed in there, not by God or by some supernatural force, but probably the creative force of the universe, if you will. It was just fate. Because once I realized that's who I was, it was much simpler, much easier to write. And what I was doing was serving a greater authority. Not God, not myself, but the highest authority, in my view, the white Aryan race. I was once, until very recently, 2014 on, a fanatical Christian. And it came to me later on that I couldn't describe myself as an Odinist, as a cosmotheist, as a Christian identity, as a creator. I view myself in one sense and one sense only, serving the white race. That in itself is enough. Where I go from that point in a religious sense is my own business and my own personal choice. But the primary spiritual strength that I get every day comes from the recognition of white power and only white power. To me, that is the epitome of everything that is just and right and true in this world. And I think if he's listening, my skinhead friend would be in agreement on this. Definitely much. And my big turnaround in life, as much as it affected me spiritually, came about on December 21st, 2012, the very date that all my colleagues back in the Ancient Mysteries group of scholars were saying was the end of the world, as the Mayan prophecy told them. Well, it didn't happen that way. They wasted a lot of Discovery Channel and Jew Channel time on that subject. But it most certainly was an end to my world at the time, and the rebirth into a new one. Death of an armchair theorist of almost anti-white Atlantean theory, and that whole transformation that happened in my life. It was traumatic. It was extreme. But what came out of that experience, which lasted a few years, was one of the most pivotal moments in my life. And I could not have done that without a faith in the white Aryan race. You can hear preachers talk to the end of the earth about putting God first, putting Christ in your life. Why don't you put the white Aryan race in your life if you're white and Aryan? You know? Forget about a circumcised rabbi. And start thinking about the goals and ideals of your people. What makes your people, the white Aryan race, significant and better than all the rest? Remember what I said, what matters is that you are white. You know, and it's a myth of the greatest proportions that we are a race which has contributed nothing useful to our people. You hear Jewish liberal professors saying it all the time. All we've done is been violent and cruel. You hear people all the time saying the one thing we were good at as the white race was being killers. We are no different. We are no different than any other group of people as far as it comes to war. You look at the blacks and what they're doing in their culture. Try to tell me they're peaceful. They're even more brutal than the most brutalist of Vikings. And the Vikings weren't that brutal. They were an ingenious, intelligent, civilized people. It is the myth that they were barbarians. Yes, they had great ethics of war and conquest and fighting, but they were worth so much more than that. They were explorers and traders, family men, raising their children. So there was more to it than that. And war is indicative of all human peoples. I would even refer to it as human. I would refer to it as humanoid. I don't believe that we are one species at all. I think we are distinct species. There's plenty of room for speculation on that and claiming that. I don't believe that we descended from African explorers who went to Europe and over the course of 10,000 years suddenly became blonde and blue-eyed. Mutations do not happen that fast, and they do not happen in 10,000 years. Sometimes not even in a million. You know, they're trying to tell you that 7,000 years ago, Europeans were all swarthy-skinned with blue eyes, and the ones further north were darker. 7,000 years. I can show you a 30,000-year-old skeleton which has perfect Nordic dimensions of skull. Okay, so you look at the Neanderthals, 50,000, 100,000 years ago. They had light skin, green to blue eyes, red to blonde hair. So, no, I don't believe that. And that poses another question. With the Jewish hold on all of our media, all our educational system, we almost have to wonder, what is true? And where did our culture really begin? Because it's often been said that Hollywood created American culture, created American sentiment, created American unity, especially in the 30s and 40s, and with so many patriotic and cultural movies were made. Even Walt Disney, who was not Jewish, he was very pro-white, and they had to get rid of him. So as soon as he died, they got his company and changed Walt Disney into the one most anti-white organizations in media beyond anything of any other branch of the Jewish-controlled media. But they created much of our culture. Not our indigenous culture, but a false culture. Superman. They were talking about the origins of that idea, the comic book character. And it has its roots in frustrated, young Jewish men who wanted to. They said, even wouldn't that be great if a Jewish man could put on glasses and get in with a nice white girl, actually calling her a white girl. Now, and it's just the way it is. So much our perception of who Hitler was, our perception of the South during the Civil War, all these things which we consider American truths of history and culture were created by the Jewish media. And I also said in my book, imagine this, any idiot on the street can tell you who Elvis Presley was, who Malcolm X was, who Martin Luther King was, who John Lennon was, who Bob Marley was, but they can't even tell you who Benjamin Franklin was. They might know who he is, but they would know nothing about him. They wouldn't know. We're going to be back in just a few minutes.
Here is Rabbi Steve Guttel, who was president and CEO of the Jewish Council for Public Affairs.
There are two issues at the top of our agenda at the very moment. One is the unbelievably important immigration debate in this country, to make sure that immigrants from around the world, particularly those from south of our border, have a chance here.
And here's an interview with Rabbi Goldschmidt.
Essentially, what you're saying is that in this boat, you're together with both Muslims
yes.
And people of other communities.
And we see ourselves together, fighting together with our Muslim brothers.
Thanks, Jews. You're listening to Renegade Broadcasting.
welcome back. We were talking early in the show about the sun gods, and one of those sun gods is the Egyptian god Horus. Now, before we get into that, I'd like to make very clear that the ancient Egyptians were not a black civilization. That's Afrocentric nonsense. There's absolutely no evidence for an advanced black civilization anywhere in the world. And the closest thing is the Dogons, which actually I will also be posting in an article tomorrow on that, which shows that they were really no different than any other unadvanced black culture, that extraterrestrials did not. There's no evidence that extraterrestrials gave them the knowledge that the Sirius B existed before any white civilization knew it existed. It turns out that that actually was never even talked about till several hundred years after the Sirius B was in fact discovered by white civilization. So there's really no evidence. They were actually referring to some other aspect of their mythology, which was not mentioned on Ancient Aliens. And I think the reason Laird Scranton, who's Jewish, and so many other ancient alien enthusiasts have written books on the Dogon, I think it's completely misplaced. You know, it would be like me, you know, giving credit to my book to some street pug in Detroit. There's really no evidence, and I don't think we should be giving credit for our discoveries to a black civilization. There's really no reason to do that. But D.M. Murdoch, who used to write for my old magazine, The New Archaeology Review, has said it on her website. Jesus Christ is not the only God supposedly born of a virgin on December 25th. So too was Horus of Egypt. And that was one of the pivotal Egyptian gods. And Joseph Maccabee, a Catholic priest for many years, writes, "Virginity in goddesses is a relative matter. Whatever we make of the original myth, Isis seems to have been born originally a virgin, or perhaps sexless goddess. And in the latter period of Egyptian religion, she was again considered a virgin goddess, demanding very strict abstinence from her devotees. It is at this period, apparently, that the birthday of Horus was annually celebrated about December 25th in the temples. At both Marcovius and the Christian writer of Paschal Chronicles say, a figure of Horus as a baby was laid in a manger in a scenic reconstruction of a stable, and a statue of Isis was placed beside it. Horus was, in a sense, the savior of mankind. He was their avenger against the powers of darkness. He was the light of the world. His birth festival was a real Christmas before Christ." And for that reason, whenever I mention Christmas and the Nativity in my book, I refer to Child of Light as all-inclusive to our Aryan origins and our Aryan beliefs and our Aryan traditions. Egypt was settled by three white peoples prior to the emergence of what you would call darker skin or reddish toned skinned Arabic and Egyptian peoples. First by old Europeans, then by Proto-Nordics, and finally Nordic Indo-European speaking peoples. And as we know, King Tut and many of the pharaohs and people even in the New Kingdom, their genes say they are of Northern European origin. And I believe that not only is Christmas a white holiday, we have the opportunity at present and in the future, to look at it as uniquely as the National Socialists did in the Third Reich. Because it seems that at this time of the year, more than any other year, we really do embrace peace on earth and goodwill towards men. And I'm not speaking in some multicultural, multiracial sense. We unite as a race. And see, that's what the Jews are scared about. Because deep down they know it's more than just a Christian holiday. They know it has pre-Christian roots. They saw the effect it had on the German population when they were truly believing that it represented the Aryan people. They don't want us united by culture. And the reason they don't want us united by culture is because that's how they have united their own people. By their myths and their lies of culture. By their arrogance, their greed, and their hatred. They have proven that being a member of their group, for them, as their clan, empowers them to strength, unity, and success in the mission they have set for themselves, which is white genocide and world domination. And most assuredly, they know that if we realize our own strength, we would rise up and tear them to pieces. They would be history. Because at one time, that's the way the white race was. And we can do it again. We can seize that opportunity. They have forced miscegenation on us. They have forced immigration on us. They have invaded our government, stripped us of their savings, and raped our families and our heritage. Do you want purple war? They are ruining our deepest festivals, our deepest traditions. They are destroying White Christmas. They are defiling it. Our sacred festival, our holy day, which is beyond just Christian or pagan origins. Something that has a great meaning for all white people. They are destroying it. Do you want total war? They're sending our boys along with black and Asian and Hispanic soldiers to fight their wars for their people. And they sit as fat Jews in Israel and watch the slaughter, not giving a single inch of blood, a single drop of blood, for their goals and ideals. No, we have to suffer. Do you want total war? They destroyed the Third Reich. They have lied about it. They have blasphemed Hitler's name. They have distorted the truth. They bombed Dresden and killed millions of innocent men, women, and children and in every German city throughout the war. They have ruined its cities. They raped millions of German women and female children as young as 2 years of age, as old as 90 and 100. With no mercy and no sense. Do you want total war? They ruined Germany again in the late 20th century and the early 21st century. By what they're doing to this very day and the thought crime laws and the oppression of our people and the deepest sense in every nation of Europe and America. Do you want for war? They tell us we can't speak up. They tell us we have no rights. They have
open affirmative action against the white population of South Africa. Put them in shacks. Deny them every single human right imaginable. Allow these vicious, jackal-like black hordes to do whatever they want to their women. Do you want total war? They will not stop until we are dead. Do you want total war? Is the most important thing next to our biological existence. Tom Robb once said, when you're given two things, nothing else. Our culture becomes third. It's what we learn growing up. I do believe that a lot of these cultural traits are genetically inherited. I think those cultural traits are racial traits, which cannot be altered. But that which is told in our environment, our children right now are growing up in a world that tells them it's wrong to be white. A world which their ancestry means nothing. But, oh, how great the black culture is. You know, I have a friend. She lives in Chicago. It's coloring books for Black History Month. And they were like, hey, Mom, check this out. Her kids are all pro-white. And she, they look at it, and their heroes are like, O.J. Simpson and Mike Tyson. You know, I mean, really, at least, she said, at least we, if we filled a coloring book, you know, it would be 300 pages of the most profound thinkers the world has ever known. Those are our heroes, and they have to invent heroes, you know, murderers and rapists as their heroes. And they're always sports leaders, you know. They complain to, I think when Trump first took office, he invited a black sports leader. And someone says, oh, they're always inviting black sports leaders, like that's all we have. And you got to think about it. Other than a bunch of crazy professors that somehow get a degree, that's like that one guy out in UCLA who said that we have to exterminate white people, their only heroes are out of the street sports heroes who shouldn't even gone to college. They had no background. They had no history. Prior to 1860, when they were released from slavery, what history did they have? And they had to make it up about Africa. They have nothing in Africa of any importance to any of them. What were they doing there when we had the heights of civilization? Yeah, I think I told you about this in a previous show, that I was hearing this guy, this black guy, talking to this other guy. He was black too. He was talking about how the whites were living in caves while the blacks were living in houses. They were so primitive, these poor whites. Lived in mud huts because there were no caves where they were living. They were living out on the savannah or in the forest. We did a lot more, and we discussed this in my last episode. They were building tunnels in these caves. They were putting star maps on the walls. They were making them into temples. They were using real ingenuity for a civilization that was already being born 40,000 years ago, since the first white habitation of Europe. The minute they got into Europe, they were already building a vast civilization. I said in the article that's going to be posted tomorrow that there was a 30,000-year civilization beneath much of Central Europe that only now is being discovered. That 40,000 years ago, there were anatomically modern white people already in much of Europe. Yet they tell us in the mainstream that 40,000 years ago, great African hunters were coming from Africa to populate Europe. Well, if that's true, then where are these 40,000-year-old anatomically modern Nordic skeletons? Where did they come from? Were they already there when these Africans migrated north? Now we learn, in reality, the African, the replacement hypothesis, as mainstream archaeologists call it, anthropologists, the out-of-Africa theory is full of holes. In fact, genetics have always shown, and they never mentioned this in any of the National Geographic shows I ever watched, that we do not descend from African haplogroups A and B, as they constantly said we were. But it took an independent analysis of the genetic evidence in Russia. People say, well, the Russians are just trying to make their mark. It makes perfect sense because in Western Europe, where socialism and political correctness rules, they're not going to tell you that. I mean, it's Swedish. The Swedes are not going to tell you. The Germans certainly are not going to tell you that the white race was first, that there was white people living in Northern Europe before any of the blacks even knew what was happening. They're not going to tell you that because they don't want to be called Nazis. Isn't that a shame? The Germans have the ability to be so much more. People say, oh, we don't want to be Nazis again. I kind of disagree. I think if they were Nazis, at least they had pride in themselves as a nation. At least they'd know who they were, which they don't know anymore. And none of them do. None of them in Europe. They're clueless. Okay? They're clueless. As that girl in the 1990s movie, Clueless. That's how clueless they are. Because they're not only clueless in the historical and anthropological and political sense, they're lost in this Jewish pop culture that defamed everything that the white race has ever created. It's about time to wake up. As I said on my last show. Next show, I'm going to have a friend come on with me, a real intelligent guy named Jeff. And he and I will be talking more in depth about actual theories and discoveries of the white Aryan race. And also ancient Aryans, which I'm going to try to nurture in my next few shows as really comprehensive discussions on this. My only problem is I don't have a lot of co-experts at this time. I started this meme. I started this reality. And I really, at this point, we welcome those who are interested in ancient Aryans who can go to ancientaryans.com to read my books, read my articles, and decide that they too can become an ancient Aryan expert in time. But civilization was created, as we know, by and large, by the Aryans, for the Aryans. And we've always believed that China was independently evolved. At least the Chinese themselves want to perpetuate that myth, that they were ahead of the West and they created, basically created civilization on their own without any help from Westerners. And as I said in one of my articles, ancient Aryans in China, it actually is not the case. In their very legends, they talk about the yellow-bearded, blue-eyed sun gods. Which, again, in ancient aliens, they said that this was an alien, the Yellow Emperor, Shang-Yi, and that he was, had like a belly that was clear and had UFOs. And he just really stupid stuff. I think it was David Wilcock that got into the part about the UFOs coming from his belly type of nonsense. He was the Yellow Emperor was a spacecraft, a large mothership. I mean, really, this goes beyond reason. It's simpler to really read the ancient Chinese texts when they tell you that, you know, these were blonde creatures. They never mention that. You know, they had a show which they were talking about the Ariak tribes. And I want to tell you how interesting this is. They said that they were the world's first people, equivalent to that of Adam and Eve. And they were a race of giants with blonde hair, and they're called the Ariak tribe. A-R-Y-A-C. A-R-Y-A-N. Aryan. So you're actually having a parallel there that's very interesting. When you hear the description of the Ariak tribe, their creations, and then take that with the Inca legends of the Viracochas, this gets very, very interesting because according to the Inca, the Viracochas predated the Inca civilization, and they were there before, and when the Inca arrived, they helped them build their civilization. You know, we were talking about hubrism, and I think I've just passed on to one of those tendencies, but I do believe, in some cases, parallels are significant. And there are instances where mythology is based on reality. You just have to be objective. The problem with ancient aliens is they take everything in mythology and everything in history and see this ancient alien interpretation. And the reason they do that is simple. They have to fill an hour a week in shows, in programming. Not to mention spinoffs and books and everything like that. So they naturally have to make stuff up. And this goes back to when I was writing Forgotten Worlds. I had to speculate and go back to what they were doing. It was data my publisher. And write all this garbage up. Because I was trying to make money. I was doing it the Jew way, unfortunately. It was when I met my friend, my colleague, if it is, Bennett Skinhead, who first counseled me and changed my life. I realized that I could make money writing, but I'd feel much better if I wrote the truth. What really was relevant to my people, to my race, to my future. And that's a realization. I think a lot of us are swept away by the society the Jews were created. And sometimes we just need someone of logic to snap them back and make them realize you're running just like all the other lemmings to the edge of the universe and off you go. I was on my way, but I realized that what I was raised with, my father, his friend Jake, and what I wanted my whole life was exactly what JP was saying. I knew that I always, deep down, had a great admiration for the pro-white movement and the Aryan race. It wasn't until I reached my greatest depth of despair, my greatest horror of life, my most horrible experience imaginable. That it didn't matter anymore what people thought. They could call me a Nazi. I could always proudly reply, I'm a National Socialist. I think we all need to get to that point. I'm a National Socialist. If you have a problem with that, get a life. I consider myself more radical than others, more on the extreme level, more on the level. We'll be back.
Again.
After getting censored relentlessly on YouTube, with video after video and channel after channel getting taken down, we have decided to try a different approach.
We now have RenegadeVids.com, which features all the documentaries, parodies, compilations, sketches, and video discussions that are simply too accurate for the kosher censors.
There are now many hours worth of hard-hitting videos waiting for you to watch and share, so get on over to RenegadeVids.com.
Welcome back. We were discussing, I don't know what we were discussing. We're having kind of a free conversation, a free monologue, if you will, of my thoughts and my ideas. We don't have a guest tonight. We are now on the last half hour of the show. I was actually was wondering if there would be any callers tonight. I would love someone to call in and have a conversation with. But we were talking about the Third Reich and National Socialism. The idea that National Socialists in Germany were this really harsh, loud, clicking their heels, so stereotypical, Germanic, and emotionless, rigid, militaristic, and hateful group of people. If you really look at videos I mean, not the few short clips where, you know, he's talking to the German youth. He says, "Oh, the German youth of the future, I want them as fast as greyhound, as hard as Leland Hall's Kruppstall. You know, that was done for effect for the masses as a speaker. He was using that to its effective ends. But even Hitler and most of the German people were very happy, smiling, relaxed, soft-spoken group of people. I mean, you'll see videos, and it's on the internet, it's on YouTube, of SS officers smiling and very unrigidly walking down of Hitler Youth and BDM and just all those, you know, the Hitler Youth and or their wives. It's a very different interpretation of National Socialist life than you would think. Hitler, they do have one surviving recording of Hitler talking to the president of Finland. And this is remarkable because he shows that even towards the end of the war, the time that the Jews say he was a raging lunatic, you know, ordering whole battalions and divisions of armies to commit what they would consider complimentary, sophisticated, I don't know German worth of anything. I speak only Kinderdeutsch, but I could tell by what he was saying that the way he was saying it, he was a very intelligent and sophisticated man with a lot of head on his shoulders, trade in the Jewish media. And, you know, another time I'd like to get into the Holocaust, what did happen and what did not happen. But even, I didn't mention this as well, we have to realize that if it did happen, if all of our counterculture ideas and theories and evidence is completely wrong, and the National Socialists did kill 6 million men, women, and children, just as the Jews purport they did, I would say it would not be a bad thing. Because I don't care if they were men, women, and children, because those children, those babies, those women, you know, that would be future generations of Jews that would be alive today causing even more havoc on the world. I also know that those 11 million, as they say, was the ultimate number of Jews that were to be exterminated. If that did happen, we would be living in a very different world today. I would not even be having this radio discussion because there would be no real reason to do it. That would have been a blessing on our race. I don't see humanity any different than I see animals in the field. In a sense, it is survival of the fittest. And even if they're winning, survival of the fittest says we have to fight to the end. May the best man win. I plan to be a member of the race that wins. There's nothing wrong in us, out of self-defense, genociding anyone. Murder, rightfully and justly done, can be a good thing. And that is how I think and believe, in the deepest sense of my existence. We know that the Jews think nothing of eliminating our people from the face of the earth. It tells me that they don't think much of life. So why should I? Why should I care what happens to a Jewish child or a Jewish mother? What do I care when a Jewish person claims that they saw their parents being taken away and then being called to work? Do I cry? Do I feel bad? Do I fall apart like they want me to? I asked, why didn't the kids go too? Because I see nothing wrong in that. I think of it as survival. Does a lion think of killing a jackal if it threatens his children? No. He tears the shit out of everybody. Because sometimes the lion has to show who he is. And there's nothing wrong in that. We are at war. If it was okay to kill and murder all those German men, women, and children in Dresden, or rape all those German women to win the war, then you've got to ask yourself, what do we have to do to end them? It's getting to that point that we shouldn't care about others. The others. The ones who are not of our race. It's time to be strong. It's time to be as hard as Krupp steel. As fast as a greyhound. And as tough as leather. That's what he was trying to say. Not as a rule that we always have to think that way, but there is a time and place for everything. There is a time when your life is threatened that you have to be as hard as Krupp Stahl, and you need to do what it takes for victory. If that means doing the unthinkable, then that's what it means. Our government didn't think anything about blowing up the Japanese with nuclear weapons. And if we had the chance, I can guarantee we would have done it to the Russians and vice versa. I'm sure the North Koreans would do that to us if they could. And I'm sure that ISIS would kill every Christian on earth if it could. I'm sure if the Jews had their ways, we'd all die. We try to put this weak morality over everything when really everybody's doing the same thing. It's like what I was talking about the Vikings. They say, oh, they were such barbarians, such warmongering savages. And you look at the way the Blacks were at that very time, headhunters, cannibals, and the things that they did were horrendous. Our people need professionalism. We need people who aren't street thugs, who aren't going to prison like they would go to a hotel room traveling across the country if that's what they did for a living. It's getting to the point now that that's all we see is a constant influx of what I would call white trash. Gotta ask yourself, we need to start gearing our message to those quality individuals within a race who can make a difference. And not just good ASM rallies. You know, I don't see. I mean, I'll be honest. I've been in the ASM. And I left. It was a horrendous organization. And 99.9% of the organizations out there are just that. They're horrendous. There are a few good ones. But you have to understand that there are a lot of quality white people, like myself, who are not on our side of the fence, but could be if they were approached by another individual like I was and engaged in conversation and got to the point where that other person decides to, in fact, invoke National Socialism. And that was the case with me. Now, the key was, as I was open-minded, I had a previous history of interest in the movement, and then it was just a matter of being moved over to do what I have to do to serve my race. This Jeff is, my friend, is a perfect example. You know, he is a very intelligent young man, and he was on the opposite side of the fence. And it was another individual in the movement, not myself, who awakened him. And basically, he is in the process of creating his own contributions, which I won't say too much about until he comes on the show. But that is his goal, is in life, is to create this business, which will be of a positive impact on our people, on our way of life. And I commend him for that. I commend him for that, knowing where he came from and how he was prior to this awakening. Now, I will also say there's also circumstances, you know, where a person is too far gone that you wouldn't even want him in your organization or her. And it's just when they showed absolutely no loyalty to their race whatsoever. And there's many out there who are like that, but it could be possible converts. It's not like Christianity. Christianity, they don't care what you've done, as long as you accept Jesus Christ as your Savior. It's just a free-for-all. You know, just accept Jesus Christ and you're free, with nothing in the past haunting you. But I think that past speaks for itself. It's like what I say about white women. You know, once you've had black, we don't want you back. It's the basic idea that if you did it once, who's to say you're going to do it again? Because to do something of that nature says you have a natural inclination to betraying your race. And those type of people are probably not the best people you want in our organization, or not in our organization, but in our movement, in our pro-white point of view. I'm not endorsing any movements at the time. But I'd like to talk a little bit about my books while things are going. White Christmas is a historical and mythological analysis of the white history and white heritage of Christmas. And it will be available within 3 weeks. When you order it, you'll be able to have it single day shipped. And we plan to have a sequel the following year, which is more of a recent history an analysis of White Christmas. It's a sequel, probably called White Christmas 2. And we're also planning to have next year a Halloween book. So this is all happening. We're also going to finally publish Ancient Aryans, which was the book I announced a few episodes ago. And we also plan a book on the movement itself. So we have a lot of interesting things. I'm also considering a biography, to write an autobiography and testimony of my involvement in the movement and what drew me to National Socialism, how it happened, how my childhood was, and how I came to be the person I am today. So a lot of these things are all projects in the works. I will be forming my own publishing company in a few months, calling it Vanner House Publishing. Vanner or Vayner were the second house of Nordic gods, who were the agricultural deities. Allr was one of them, and also Frey was once a Vayner. So we're going to have that, and I'm still working on getting a network set up. That's definitely in the works. I don't think it's going to be very soon. because it's going to cost me a certain amount of money, which I don't have. I live a very Spartan and rather impoverished lifestyle. But I think that I'm also planning a new website. I'm calling it archaeologyauthor.com, and it's going to be a more archaeological-oriented type website with both a e-magazine and a network. So we're looking at that in the next 6 months to have that up and running. My main priority, though, outside doing these shows as a guest host on Renegade, is producing books. And there will be a lot of books being published in the next few months, a year to 2 years. So I haven't produced a whole lot since 2013. It's been pretty much a zone out time for me. But we are steadily working. Myself and Dave Gaheri of the American Free Press to working on all of these projects, as well as working with Kyle Hunt on websites and magazines and things like that. I'm also in touch with a few other individuals who do my web hosting and other things. So we're slowly creating our own following, our own basis. And that's going well. One of the things I do have here is this article by Dan Murdoch, which I was quoting from you before. I just want to read from you one last aspect here, one last quote. It says, "The virgin birth of Petra." And Petra, it was once the capital of Arabia. It's the famous facade you see in Indiana Jones in The Last Crusade, coming through the place, and they have the Holy Grail in there and all that. "The same event of the pagan virgin goddess giving birth to the divine son was celebrated also by Arabs at the ancient site of Petra in Jordan, as likewise recounted by Athenaeus. This also goes on in the city of Petra, in the idolatrous temple there. Petra is the capital city of Arabia, the scriptural Edom. They praise the virgin with hymns in the Arab language and call her Chimu, that is, core, or virgin in Arabic. And the child was born of her, they call her Disraeles, that is, only the son of the Lord. And this is also done on the right side of Eleusa, and there in Petra in Alexandria. And Joseph Campbell, who was a mythologist, wrote The Hero with a Thousand Faces, says, we learn from the 4th century saint and churchman Athenaeus, for example, of an annual festival observed in Alexandria on January 6th, the date assigned to the Epiphany and originally the Nativity of Christ, and to the baptism as well. The pagan occasion was in celebration of the birth of the year god Ion to the virgin goddess Kor, a Hellenized transformation of Isis. So basically what you're seeing here is an ongoing transformation from pre-Christian to Christian. You see an evolution there. You see a fact that rather than the type of pro-Christian view we have of the rising of teen in the Christian church and the conversion or forced conversion of the pagans, we see that even early on, you know, as the so-called church evolved just before Constantine, we see a definite element of evolution and see that it actually is of pagan origin. I'm not sure, and I'm not 100% sure, how this whole idea of the sun god being associated with a Jewish crucified criminal. That is kind of interesting. But when you look at the whole Bible itself, it's really based on astrology and about old Aryan myths. And this is not talked about. This is not acknowledged by any of the current camps. But it is a reality. These are stolen ideas. Which means if they are stolen from other faiths, other mythologies, then they're not genuine. And they're not the truth. But the white Aryan race is the truth. Service to this people is the highest order and the highest truth. If you don't understand that, then you don't understand your own existence if you're white. Struggle for us all. A professionalism of quality, not quantity. Victory for the Aryan race, and victory for our ancestral culture and religion. It is a future for us. And that future is within reach. We just have to envision ourselves. A minority of one. I know I'm right. So that's the truth. That's every revolution begins with one man with a vision. And I sure as heck hope that I am not the only one alive who sees it with that clarity. I long to find others and acknowledge others who love the white Aryan race as much as I do.
Used by heathen folk for thousands of years. These tried and true remedies are hand-prepared with only the finest of ingredients and are made with love by fellow heathen, Sinead McCarthy. HeathenHerbs.com is your home for all your natural health needs. We feature herbal tinctures, magnesium and colloidal silver products, perfumes, balms, salves, and will soon be offering shampoos, conditioners, tooth powder, deodorant, and plant-based makeup. Check us out today at heathenherbs.com and use the coupon code RENEGADE at the checkout for 15% off your entire order.
Es wird still und er fängt an zu erzählen von der Zeit aus seiner Jugend und wie es damals war. Seine Gefährten leben längst nicht mehr, verstorben und verschollen. Und er erinnert sich an jeden Tag, als wenn es erst gestern war.